This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. First up in Forbes magazine, Brain Man. Harriet Tabuteau combined a Yale medical degree with 2 decades in finance to start biotech firm Axiom. Now, its success with drugs for neurological disorders has made the Haiti-born immigrant a new billionaire. When Harriet Tabuteau started a drug development company in 2012, he decided to do so differently. First, he'd focus on brain disorders, treatments for which are notoriously difficult to develop and whose efficacy can be hard to prove. And he'd be both CEO and the scientific founder, bringing to bear his decades of experience investing in biotech startups and his medical training. But he'd take no venture capital, self-funding with help from friends and family. Quote, if you do things exactly the same way as everybody else, you're going to have the same outcomes as everybody else. And we wanted to have outcomes that stand apart. Close quote, Tabuteau, who is 57 years old, said during his first ever interview with a reporter about his company, Axiom Therapeutics. Named for 2 parts of a nerve cell, the axon and the soma, Axiom has come a long way from its beginnings in a windowless 3-desk office in New York Rockefeller Center, affectionately remembered as, quote, the broom closet, close quote. Today it has 3 drugs on the market and 5 in the pipeline, with the potential to help the estimated 150 million Americans suffering from conditions like depression, ADHD, or Alzheimer's disease. Revenue for the 12 months ended in June, reaching $495 million, up 70% from the same period in 2024. Axiom is not yet profitable, booking a net loss of $247 million in that time. The company trades on the NASDAQ with a market cap of $6.1 billion. Tabuteau is a billionaire thanks to his 15% stake in it, plus options. He figures Axiom could hit $16.5 billion in peak sales from its current drug portfolio, which would put it among the top 25 drug companies by revenue today. That's assuming all goes to plan, most particularly getting 5 new drugs through the FDA between now and 2028. It's a big ask. Only about 25% of drugs do well enough in Phase 3 trials to move forward in the FDA process. Tabuteau was born in Haiti, where his birth mother struggled to raise him and his sister. He recalls experiencing neglect of all kinds, quote, physical, nutritional, emotional, close quote, but quote, it taught me resilience, close quote, he says now. At age 9, he moved with his dad and adoptive mom to Manhattan's Upper East Side. Degrees in molecular biology and biochemistry from Westland led him to Yale School of Medicine, where he planned to become a neurosurgeon. But he was so unsettled by the transparent unhappiness of his physician professors that he opted against a neurosurgery residency in favor of a job at Goldman Sachs Healthcare Investment Banking Group. That was the start of a nearly 2-decade career in finance that included stints at Bank of America's Securities and Hedge Fund, HealthCo / SAC Capital, as well as managing his own funds. From his perch on Wall Street, he watched thousands of early-stage biotechs succeed and fail, and began to develop his own theories about what worked and why. While most biotechs focus on just one drug, he realized that building a portfolio would cut the risk of a flop. To keep costs low, he shunned the industry's practice of outsourcing clinical trials, betting he could do it cheaper and with greater chance of success in-house. A Phase 3 trial could easily cost $50 million. Tabuteau could do it for 30% to 50% less. Quote, we got a lot of pushback, close quote, he says, as investors didn't believe he could run so many trials on such a low budget. Working on multiple drugs helped. When one trial ended, his researchers would immediately begin work on the next. Hedging his bets was wise. After going public in 2015, Axiom struggled, not unusual for an early-stage biotech, as drugs can take 10 years to get from idea to market, and while Axiom's trials were cheaper, they were not cheap. The company's stock puttered along under $10 for years. Its market cap dipped below $100 million after an early drug for pain flunked its clinical trial. Quote, "Nobody believed in Axum years ago, and I think there's still a lot of unbelievers," close quote, says Axum Chief Financial Officer Nick Pizzi. Quote, "It's a show-me story," close quote. Axum's prospects skyrocketed with its first big drug, Auvelity. When the treatment for major depressive disorder gained FDA approval in August 2022, shares popped 65% in a week, valuing the company at $3 billion. The drug combines two existing medications for a treatment that can begin to work in just 1 week, compared to 6 or 8 weeks for serotonin-based antidepressants, a huge advantage. To launch it, Axum started with 165 sales reps, less than half of what is typical. But it paired those reps with software that could identify which docs were likely to be receptive to its products and to determine whether they'd prefer email, a phone call, or a face-to-face meeting. Auvelity is now on track to do $500 million in sales this year, and analysts figure the drug should become a blockbuster, industry parlance for a medication with more than $1 billion in revenue. Earlier this year, the company resolved patent litigation that will keep copycats off the market until at least 2038, a big win. Tabatua's finance expertise also paid off. In 2022, Axum acquired a drug called Sunosi, which treats excessive daytime sleepiness in people with narcolepsy or sleep apnea. After pulling together a deal to buy it for $53 million plus single-digit royalties in just 2 weeks over Christmas in 2021, Axum was able to more than recoup its money when Tabatua sold the European, Middle Eastern, and North African rights to the drug for $66 million plus milestones and royalties. Less than a year later, Sunosi's revenue is now over $100 million annually. Quote, "It was a very shrewd financial transaction," close quote, says Mizuho analyst Craig Suvanove. Shares have kept climbing, shooting up 35% over the past year to a recent $122, outperforming the NASDAQ Biotech Index, which is up just 1% over the same period. The next treatment to watch, a drug to treat the agitation that often accompanies Alzheimer's disease. Antipsychotic medications, and currently the only treatment available, have serious risks, including death. Axum's drug avoids these side effects, but has reported mixed results in phase 3 clinical trials. Axum plans to file for approval before the end of September. It's possible the FDA may not greenlight it, but analysts expect the need for an alternative to antipsychotics makes approval likely. It's core to Tabatua's plans to get to $16.5 billion. He projects $1 billion to $3 billion in sales for Auvelity and $1.5 billion to $3 billion from the Alzheimer's agitation drug annually at their peak. Quote, "There is so much ahead of us right now in terms of the pipeline and the number of patients we're able to address," close quote, he says. Quote, "We might be a small company in terms of size, but we're not a small company in terms of fundamentals or in terms of ambition," close quote. Here's a sidebar. Individual innovation. Axum Therapeutics founder Harriet Tabatua has more than 400 patents, including for Auvelity, a depression drug that has his own company licensed from him for about $9 million last year. But inventive businessmen are not a new thing. Back in 1979, Forbes visited the chaotic Midtown Manhattan office of Robert Lester, a, quote, "independent inventor," close quote, who had big ideas for everything from hidden windshield wipers to an imaging typewriter to a, quote, "ultrasonic location system," close quote, something like an early Apple AirTag. Lester did quite well for himself, but unlike Tabatua, never really struck it big. It's not easy being a full-time independent inventor in this age of technology. The days of lucrative tinkering in the garage Henry Ford style are all but over. Lester figures there can't be more than 100 men like him left in the country. But Lester, who holds around 50 U.S. patents and has a few more pending, isn't complaining. He makes a comfortable living. Quote, "I have my bad years and my good years, but I live out with all the millionaires in Manhasset. I manage never to earn less than $50,000 a year. Quote, to be very honest with you, manufacturing never really interested me. When I finish an invention, even before I finish writing the patent application, I'm not interested in it anymore. I'm interested in new things." Here's a sidebar, How to Play It by John D. Markman. With medicine entering a brave new world, aggressive biotech firms are exploiting untapped markets through innovation. Vertex Pharmaceuticals is leading the charge. Best known for its cystic fibrosis drugs that can treat 95% of all people living with the illness, Vertex is working on cutting-edge therapies, including mRNA treatments developed with Moderna. Second quarter 2025 sales reached $2.96 billion, up 12% year-over-year, with full-year guidance raised to a high end of $12 billion. Building on its profitable core and breakthrough partnerships, Vertex is positioned to capture future demand. Shares could climb to $520 within 18 months, a gain of more than 30% from current levels. John D. Markman is president of Markman Capital Insight and editor of Digital Creators and Consumers. Next up in Forbes, Zone Offense. With a combination of cash incentives, stock options, and aggressive financial engineering, AutoZone made a billionaire out of its founder and millionaires of thousands of its employees. But can one of the top stocks of the last three decades keep it up in the face of new rivals and fewer gearheads? Phil Daniele was working for a competing auto parts chain when AutoZone entered the Jacksonville, Florida market in 1986. Daniele had worked in car stores since high school, paying his way through college by stocking shelves. He joined AutoZone in 1993 as a store manager in training before being given his own store after a few months. The first of 10 titles in three decades. Quote, I'm not a phenomenon. If you look at our leadership team, many of our VPs started out in an hourly role at a store, close quote, says Danielle, 56, who is now CEO of AutoZone. Today, AutoZone, known for its universal Get in the Zone AutoZone radio jingle, employs 126,000 people with over 6,500 stores in the U.S. and another 1,000 in Mexico and Brazil. The retailer sells everything from motor oil and upholstery cleaner to specialized car parts for nearly every make and model. With $18.5 billion in sales last year, it is worth about $70 billion. In the last 20 years, its shares have returned an average of 21% annually, trouncing the S&P 500's 11% average return, including dividends reinvested. Over the same period, AutoZone has generated nine-figure-plus windfalls for its original private equity sponsor, KKR, hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert, and its founder, Pitt Hyde, who stepped down as CEO in 1996. Quote, I wish I had never diversified. That was a huge mistake, close quote, jokes Hyde, 82, who is worth around $2 billion today. He sold most of his AutoZone stock back in the 1990s. Had he kept it, he'd be worth over $10 billion. But it's not just AutoZone's investors and top brass who have gotten rich, and that is the company's real secret sauce. With a compensation system built around stock options, the retailer has made many of its rank and file wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. More than 4,000 AutoZone employees, including many like Danielle, who began as hourly employees or store managers in the 1980s and 90s, have become millionaires from their AutoStock zone, Hyde says. Quote, our compensation structure is one of the key elements of our success, close quote, says Bill Rhodes, chair of the board since 2007 and AutoZone's CEO and president from 2005 to 2023. Quote, there are very, very few companies that are still 100% stock options in their long-term incentives. That's what we are with our senior leadership team, close quote. Following a 2006 accounting rule change requiring companies to record options as expenses on their income statement, many S&P 500 companies have favored compensation packages with restricted and performance-based stock units, grants of stock with no exercise price, over stock options, the right to buy a stock at the price on the date it was awarded. But AutoZone stayed the course and has granted options awards to eligible employees every year for the past 25 years, equal to 0.9% of its total shares outstanding. Executives can also elect to take 25% of their annual compensation in AutoZone stock. Quote, our people want the risk. They want the leverage that comes with stock options. Close quote, says Rhodes, who has netted over $500 million exercising options and selling the stock before taxes. As it's grown, AutoZone has restricted eligibility of stock option awards to about 400 higher-level employees, down from over 38,000 in the late 90s. Today, store managers who drive AutoZone's retail sales are incentivized with cash bonuses based on sales quotas. Store hands are supposed to ask people if they need help within 30 seconds of a customer walking into the store. They perform routine maintenance, like changing batteries or installing wipers, at no cost and on site. Hit your targets and drive sales, and you'll be compensated for it. Or better yet, one day you may end up in corporate, which means stock options whose value only seems to go up. Employees can also buy up to $15,000 in AutoZone stock annually at a 15% discount to market price through an employee stock purchase plan. The idea is to keep the sales force aligned, invested in AutoZone's future, and motivated to sell, sell, sell. At corporate, the mantra has been buy, buy, buy back its own stock. AutoZone has purchased $38 billion of its shares since 1998 through May of 2025, reducing its outstanding share count by over 90% from 152 million to 16.7 million as of June. 1998 is also when it started limiting stock options. The company has bought back more shares over time, 155.5 million, than it originally had outstanding, 152 million. How is that mathematically possible? It's because of the dilution from all those stock options the company awards. The model has proven durable thanks to AutoZone's earnings moving in only one direction. Since 1987, revenue has increased every year, growing 11.5% annually, while operating income, $3.3 billion last year, and net income, $2.6 billion last year, have increased in all but 3 years. The company has been disciplined in its capital expenditure, opting for slow and steady earnings growth over breakneck expansion. It helps that the auto parts industry cruises through recessions as cash-stripped drivers opt to fix rather than replace their cars. Quote, if you put financial engineering on top of a bad business, you're just going to go out of business faster, close quote, Rhodes says. Quote, if you have a really good business, putting financial engineering on top of that can optimize performance, or as I sometimes like to say, put it on steroids, close quote. But to keep its well-oiled machine chugging, AutoZone needs to keep growing. It holds $9 billion in long-term debt on which it must pay interest, $450 million last year, and it has accelerated share repurchases, averaging $3.6 billion in annual share buybacks from 2021 through 2024, compared to an average of $1.2 billion the previous decade. Its biggest headaches are macro headwinds. For one, its beloved DIY customer, the fixer-up guy who comes into the local AutoZone store to be charmed by a motivated salesman, is, quote, a bit of a dying breed, close quote, says Philip Blee, a consumer equity analyst at William Blair. In 1990, over half of Americans identified as car DIYers, but today, DIYers account for only a fifth of the total $400 billion automotive aftermarket. Not only have parts gotten more expensive, cutting into the value proposition, but cars have become harder to repair as they have become more complex and computerized. AutoZone also faces growing competition for the diehard DIYers from the likes of Walmart, Costco, and Amazon. Quote, the big box retailers are some of the more near-term threats, close quote, Blee says. AutoZone increasingly sells directly to repair shops, both independent and national chains, a market that now accounts for an estimated 75% of the entire industry and 90% of its growth, according to William Blair. In this space, where customer service is less about face-to-face salesmanship and more about delivering parts faster than anyone else, its biggest rival, O'Reilly Auto Parts, has raced ahead, generating $7.8 billion last year from commercial sales, compared to AutoZone's $5.9 billion. Danielle sees that not as a failure, but an opportunity. He says AutoZone is beefing up its distribution network with new mega hubs that hold over 100,000 unique car parts for nearly any vehicle, from your sister's new Toyota Camry to your neighbor's beat-up Chevy Corvette. Quote, we've worked on our strategy of expanding our supply chain. We've run it too tight before, close quote, says the CEO, who ran the commercial business from 2015 to 2021. And AutoZone isn't loosening its grip on DIYers. It's just looking for them in different places. The chain plans to open 500 new stores in 2028, up from the 190 it has averaged the last 5 years, 200 of them in Mexico and Brazil. AutoZone is nothing if not adaptable. Joseph Pitt Hyde III founded the company, then called Auto Shack, in 1979 after seeing the writing on the wall for his family business, Memphis, Tennessee-based Malone & Hyde, which sold groceries to independent mom-and-pop grocery stores and small chains in the South. He watched as Walmart, on whose board he sat from 1978 to 1983, gobbled up his market share. His idea was to take Walmart's retailer-distributor model, combine it with a shiny supermarket aesthetic, and bring it to a smaller industry with fatter margins. Auto parts, which combined fixed prices, inelastic demand, and no clear national brand, struck him as a clear winner. He researched the industry for a year before opening his first store in Forest City, Arkansas. Within 5 years, he had 170 stores. Quote, I learned so much from Sam Walton about his whole productivity cycle, close quote, Hyde recalls. Quote, he was growing rapidly, and as he leveraged his central overhead, he gained buying power. Rather than putting it on the bottom line, he reflected it in lower prices. And that's what we instituted at AutoZone, close quote. Clear-eyed about the trajectory of his two businesses' futures, Hyde took Malone & Hyde private with KKR in 1984 and spun out AutoZone, renamed after a lawsuit by Radio Shack, 2 years later. Quote, it was really modeled after Walmart, low prices, great customer service, a good old-fashioned way of doing things, close quote, says George Roberts, KKR's billionaire co-founder, which made a $2.3 billion on its AutoZone stake. Hyde stepped down as CEO and board chair in 1996 after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. Hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert, best known for merging Sears with Kmart, built a 30% stake in AutoZone between 1998 and 2001, and came to its board with ideas, including the share buyback program. Quote, he pitched for us to change our capital allocation, close quote, recalls Rhodes, who was then SVP of finance. Quote, we've continued to use that over the years, and it's gotten bigger and bigger, close quote. AutoZone's smartest bet was its $57 million acquisition in 1996 of vehicle diagnostics database AllData, which employees use constantly to identify the exact car part and given customer needs and how much it will cost. As AutoZone enters its next chapter, Danielle is determined to uphold what made it so successful and so rewarding. Quote, our culture has modified and morphed a little bit, but the primary tenets are the same, close quote, he says. Quote, if you're committed to the industry and committed to the culture, you can do anything at this company, close quote. If AutoZone can keep its stock market magic alive and its flock faithful, he just might be right. Here's a sidebar. How to Play It by John Buckingham. While riches have amassed for auto parts sellers like AutoZone and electric vehicle king Tesla has found investor fancy as a technology play, the traditional car makers themselves offer tremendous total return potential in a stock market trading at all-time highs. After all, General Motors, Honda Motor, and Volkswagen have ridden a decent sales environment to solid profits in recent years, fueling significant investment in electric vehicles to go along with healthy internal combustion engine businesses. While I'm not looking for massive increases in their bottom lines, I think consistently robust net income should be rewarded with higher forward price-to-earnings ratios than the current single-digit levels, especially as GM has also been buying back a truckload of stock. Honda has a lucrative motorcycle business, and Volkswagen holds a sizable ownership stake in Porsche. All three also reward shareholders with dividend payouts. John Buckingham is editor of The Prudent Speculator. Here's another sidebar. View it yourself. DIYers might still grab supplies from the local Home Depot or AutoZone, but the how-to guide went online long ago. Here is a handful of hands-on influencers with seven-figure followings on YouTube. Chris Fix, 10.8 million followers. Advice on how to do a brake job, replace a transmission, or restore your car's headlights using toothpaste. Karina Garcia, with 9 million followers, the Gen Z popular queen of slime, has recipes for making ultra-clear slime, thick and glossy slime, even slime in bulk. Dad, How Do I?, with 5.3 million followers. Rob Kenny's father abandoned him at age 14. Now he posts tutorials on topics like how to tie a tie, shave, or start a campfire. Home Renovision DIY, with 3.8 million followers. Contractor Jeff Thorman explains how to do everything from painting a wall to finishing an entire basement. Kip K, with 2.5 million followers, an early YouTuber, he joined before Google bought the site in 2006 with gadget hacks such as how to charge your phone with a flashlight or make a Wi-Fi signal booster with a beer can. Moving to Barron's, Elevation Points' Jim Dixon. Why we make only minority investments in RIAs. The former Merrill executive and head of Sanctuary Wealth explains the strategy behind his new firm. This was written by Steve Garmazin. If a registered investment advisory firm sells a slice of its business to an investor, it will get a nice chunk of change, but will ultimately trade away a portion of its profits. Jim Dixon and his team at one-year-old Elevation Point Wealth Partners have so far convinced 8 firms that it is worth it, and they plan to persuade at least 10 more every year. Quote, they usually realize over time that they might have a smaller part of the pie, but if the pie is a lot bigger in the long term, they still win, close quote, says Dixon. Denver-based Elevation Point buys minority stakes and provides platform services, business guidance, and sub-acquisition assistance to its partner firms, although none of the latter 3 offerings is mandatory, explains Dixon. Speaking with Barron's advisor, Dixon, who founded and helped build RIA platform Sanctuary Wealth to $35 billion before starting Elevation Point, explains what's in these deals for firms and their end clients. He argues that a widely feared advisor shortage has been overhyped, and he explains why many firms that think they're going to win through artificial intelligence will not. So now there are question and answers here. Describe your career path before Elevation Point. Dixon, I started my career at Merrill Lynch. In 2016, after 26 years, I left to start a firm called Sanctuary Wealth, which we built to $35 billion or so. And then I really wanted to get into the minority investing business. So we started Elevation Point so we could build a portfolio of minority investments in the wealth management RIA space. Question, what is your business model at Elevation Point? Dixon, I think the basic thing is we're a minority investor. We think that's advantageous for our partner firms because they and their clients are in control. Today, a lot of people sell their whole firm or join a platform, and we feel like that forces them into a cookie-cutter setting. At Elevation Point, we're trying to establish the ability to invest in great firms and make them greater, but not change the way they deliver the client experience. And if you think about a lot of the aggregator models, it's like we're going to buy this great firm, and then as soon as we buy them, we're going to have them change everything they do and do it like we do it. To us, that just didn't make sense, because if you're buying a great firm, why do you want to change everything? And I think that change is what clients sometimes get frustrated with. They love the advisor, and they love the way they were doing business. On the platform side, what's interesting is that it's become a real cookie-cutter approach. It's like, listen, you want to be independent, but here's your platform and here's everything you're going to use. We find that platforms often are good at taking people independent, but not very good at helping them thrive in independence. So we tried to land in the middle, platform and PE. We don't take a controlling stake, we take a minority stake, and then like any good investor would, we bring resources to help our partners improve their client experience. That might be enhanced technology or enhanced solutions or just intellectual firepower. But trying to bring all those things to a team while they still own and control the LLC. They control the client experience, which is important to us because we want to give them the best technology and the best solutions, but allow them to use it their way. We think that's the magic sauce. We've landed in the middle between a platform all the way on the left and a full aggregator on the right. Question, how does your platform offering work? We've got a full technology stack that partners can customize to their firm, and we've got a full solution stack. But we don't mandate any of those things. They are there, and they are optional. What we try to do is to be consultative. We sit down and say, quote, where are you great? What are the things you're doing well? Keep doing those. What are the things we can do better? Close quote. That's where we might bring new ideas or solutions to enhance their practice. If you think about our business plan, we're an investor, and as an investor, we want to deliver two things, enhanced growth and an elevated client experience. And that's where we think the functionality can be helpful. But the decision, and I think this is the key thing for advisors and their clients, needs to lie with the advisor as to what they want to use and how they want to use it. In our opinion, when those things get forced on them, that's when the client experience deteriorates and the advisor gets frustrated. Question, what do your target firms look like and what size stake do you prefer to take? Dixon, for all the work we do and value we're going to bring, we feel like the smallest slice of the apple that makes sense is 20%. We normally come in anywhere between 20 and 49%. We're not interested in taking controlling stakes. We just want to be a partner in good firms and help them be even better. We're not into turnarounds. We're looking for the best in our sweet spot, which is between $500 million and $5 billion in assets. We go in and say, quote, how can we enhance this firm but still allow them to have control and dictate this client experience, close quote, because we feel that's what they know best. Question, how much do you think the firm can grow in, say, 5 years? Dixon, we have almost $10 billion of assets under supervision now. Our business plan calls for bringing in at least 10 to 15 teams and probably $10 billion to $15 billion a year. I'm sure there will be some years where we do a little more or a little less based on market conditions. But our plan is to stay consistent, stay disciplined, and do this the right way over a long period with the right partnerships. Question, what do your partner firms trade off in exchange for your investment? Dixon, they're trading off cash flow. I think the thought process they go through a lot of times is, if I'm going to sell 20% of this, which means I'm going to give up 20% of my profits, can that partner help me improve enough so that my firm's going to be worth more? A lot of firms we talk to are focused on their slice of the pie at first. They usually realize over time that they might have a smaller part of the pie, but if the pie is a lot bigger, they still win. And I think for a lot of people, the mentality is, I'm a good advisor, but I could use help. It's become hard to do all these things. Technology, digital marketing, family office services, alternative investments. So we've built this ecosystem within Elevation Point that they can plug into for what they need, when they need it, to turbocharge their growth. The other part of this is that we step in a lot of times where there's succession planning going on, and the senior partner wants their junior partners to take over the practice. But those junior partners don't have the liquidity. So we step in as a third party to make that work. Question, how often do these companies take your cash and go make acquisitions? Dixon, historically, I've done a lot of this with partner firms I've invested in. While most of our relationships at Elevation Point are relatively new, we expect to work extensively with teams on acquisitions and tuck-ins as part of their growth strategy. Question, let's say I'm a client of a $1 billion firm and they announce they have sold a stake to you. What's in this for me? Dixon, better infrastructure, technology, HR, compliance, all those things. And I think more importantly, better solutions. We've got a whole wealth solutions team that's out there every day looking for the best private market opportunities, the best insurance solutions, ways we can set up jumbo mortgages. How can we bring a complete toolbox to our advisors? We've tried to build a complete open architecture, so when the advisor sits down with that client to talk about a loan, they can show them Goldman Sachs, they can show them BNY, they can show them anyone. For most individual teams, it's hard to do all that diligence and to build that toolbox. We've built the toolbox, but the difference in our model is we don't shove it down everyone's throat. Question, what's your biggest business challenge currently? Dixon, I think it's data. The world is changing very quickly with AI, and we're all learning that you can't really use AI the way we all want to get more efficiencies and profitability if your data are not in the right order. Right now, the team and I are spending a tremendous amount of time making sure that our data are in order and we can create those workflows and those efficiencies and build in an agentic workforce to help us make sure that we're efficiently building the business and doing it in the most cutting-edge ways. A lot of RIAs talk about AI, but they don't really have a data strategy that allows them to do it. We're investing heavily in the people and the technology to make sure we can do it in a value-added way for the firms we invest in. Question: what do you mean specifically by having your data in order? Can you give an example? Dixon: if you think about the RIA space today, you have a lot of different vendors in fintech. I think we've gotten to a point where a company like Elevation Point can take all of those data from all the different partners we have, whether those are custodians or fintech firms, whether they're doing billing or reporting or any of the different functionalities, and we can bring them into a centralized data warehouse. We can then use that data to guide our strategic direction and make informed decisions that help each partner firm grow. Compliance, client service, and accounting are areas that we can do a lot faster and a lot cheaper if we've got our data clean. But to do that, you have to bring the data into a central location so you can actually make it happen. That's what the best firms are doing right now. Question: so you want the data to be centrally accessible, and in terms of clean data, you're doing things like removing duplicates and fixing errors, correct? Dixon: correct. Question: will AI help to solve the 100,000 advisor shortage that McKinsey has warned of? Dixon: I have a really different opinion on this. I think AI is going to make us a lot more profitable and a lot more efficient and a lot more flexible and customizable to clients. But I want to be clear that I think the advisor will always be the center of the relationship. I don't think AI is ever going to have empathy, and I don't think AI is going to be a great listener. I think of it like maybe AI gets you down the field faster, but it's always going to take a human connection to really satisfy the client. As far as that advisor shortage, I do think a lot of advisors are going to retire, but the future is bright because college students have wanted to be investment bankers or consultants at McKinsey or consultants at Ernst & Young, and the junior ranks of those businesses are being hit harder by AI than anywhere else. Because of that, I think a lot of the younger talent coming out of business school today are opening their eyes to wealth management. I'm seeing record interest across young men and women in getting into our field. The challenge for all of us is to train and develop them differently than we have in the past. They don't want to be salespeople. They want to be wealth advisors and client advocates. We've got to reimagine our training, but I think we're going to get the opportunity to hire a lot of really talented young people and train them to be great wealth advisors. Question: is AI going to really reduce the ranks of the back office? Dixon: we might be naive to say that it wouldn't, but I do believe some job elimination in the back and middle office will happen with AI over time. We're already starting to see it. Continuing in Barron's, tech spending sparks worries. Most borrowers can handle it. Technology titans have high credit ratings and robust free cash flow, one strategist notes. Plus, market newsletter commentary on vendor financing, the 2026 outlook, and the S&P 500's technical setup. The tech spending spree. November 14th. Debt financing bears watching, but most companies are adding leverage from a position of strength, supported by high credit ratings and robust free cash flow margins, though moderating from elevated levels. Importantly, many large-cap tech leaders such as Google, Microsoft, and Amazon generate hundreds of billions of dollars annually from diverse revenue streams to help fund the investment. History offers perspective. In the 1990s, Amazon faced similar skepticism over aggressive spending and lack of profits. Those investments ultimately paved the way for AWS, a major growth engine, although the stock endured a volatile path along the way. While capital misallocation is inevitable and there will be winners and losers, the long-term innovation cycle remains intact. From a broader perspective, sentiment is resetting quickly, which should eventually set the stage for stocks to reclimb the proverbial wall of worry. Indeed, the latest survey from the American Association of Individual Investors showed the percentage of investors with a bearish outlook spiked to 49%, a two-month high, which, from a contrarian perspective, can be viewed as a positive. And vendor financing. November 14th. Vendor financing, a key factor in the formation and collapse of the dot-com bubble, has declined significantly. Our examination of events in the lead-up to the dot-com bubble suggests that we are unlikely in one now. Vendor financing was prevalent during the telecom boom. Equipment manufacturers helped finance smaller companies with limited creditworthiness or large infrastructure projects that traditional financial institutions were cautious about, accepting greater risk to facilitate sales and expand market share in a competitive sector in the late 1990s. At its peak, vendor financing from North American suppliers exceeded 120% of their pre-tax earnings based on our estimates. The financial reforms in the early 2000s fundamentally changed vendor financing practices with enhanced disclosure requirements and more rigorous accounting standards. Fast forward to today, we estimate that the recent collaboration between NVIDIA, Oracle, and OpenAI represents only about 5% of NVIDIA's projected pre-tax earnings for 2026. The cautionary tale of the dot-com bubble has also led companies to prioritize organic growth over a reliance on credit-driven strategies. Leading tech companies today generate more stable revenue streams and have maintained stronger cash positions and balance sheets. As they continue to demonstrate solid earnings growth, we believe the valuations of today's tech giants are justified. 2026 Investment Outlook, November 13th. With valuations stretched and the global bull market mature, we will be watching to see if equities withstand four-year cycle headwinds and other challenges ahead. At 3% for 2026, global real GDP growth should be little changed from the current year's growth, but that will require supportive monetary and fiscal policies to offset the continuation of policy uncertainty and geopolitical risk. We favor bonds over cash in our global and Europe allocations. Benign long-term inflation expectations should help bonds, although the reduced volatility will leave the developed bond markets vulnerable to shocks. The subdued global growth environment supports a muted outlook for broad community returns, but precious metals should outperform. We're bullish on gold and bearish on the U.S. dollar index. Our regional equity positioning includes an overweight allocation to emerging markets and an underweight allocation to the U.S. positions likely to remain. S&P 500 technical checkup, November 12th. The S&P 500 remains firmly in a long-term uptrend. The index rallied strongly at the end of October before pulling back to test its 10-week moving average, 50-day MA, earlier this month. Over the past 2 years, it has consistently found support near the 10-week MA, rarely declining as far as the 40-week MA. Below the 10-week MA, solid support lies around 6,540 near the recent lows, and additional support at the former resistance level near 6,150 where the 40-week MA currently resides, about 10.2% below current levels. As long as the 10-week MA continues to act as support, we don't expect this lower level to be tested. Traffic layoffs. Even when government data are readily available, we like to keep an eye on the monthly Challenger layoff report. Last week's update confirmed what we've noticed in our own news feeds, that layoff announcements have moved up, although the Challenger release indicated they remain well below the levels of the Doge spike. While several industries saw an increase in layoff announcements, what we noticed were increases for both tech and industrial goods. While the latter makes sense in the context of tariffs, it is something to monitor as spikes in industrial layoffs often occur during periods of financial market stress, and those for October came in similar to those seen in the 2015-2016 industrial recession. Tech layoffs also tend to move up during periods of market stress, but interest us for a different reason. In this category, we've seen several spikes since 2020, and what came through in October doesn't look unusual for the post-COVID era. Moving on to Fortune magazine. Want a bet? Why investors are gambling on Kalshi and Polymarket. The 2024 election showed the potential and popularity of quote-unquote prediction markets, but the startups and their headstrong young founders still face long odds. This is written by Jeff John Roberts. Over Labor Day weekend, social media lit up with observations that President Trump had not been seen in public for several days. Soon rumors swirled about Trump's health. and ghoulish hashtags even claimed he had died. Yes, it was just another weekend in the online rumor mill, but this round of speculation came with a novel twist, a flurry of bets about the president's health on so-called prediction market sites. On Kalshi, the odds of Vice President J.D. Vance taking office by the end of the year shot up to 15%. For Kalshi customers, a wager of $15 would mean a payout of $100 if Vance took office. Trump's alleged disappearance, of course, proved a false alarm. By Tuesday, the internet had moved on to other diversions, but not before pundits blasted Kalshi and its prediction markets rival Polymarket for running quote-unquote assassination markets, where the public could indirectly wager on the death of a public figure. Those accusations may have been overblown, not least because one of Trump's sons invests in and advises both Kalshi and Polymarket. But the episode showed how prediction markets, long the province of a niche clique of academics, have suddenly become a mainstay of politics and the news cycle. They are also on the cusp of becoming big business. Kalshi and Polymarket have been around for 7 and 5 years respectively, but their big breakout came during last year's U.S. presidential election campaign. Over the course of several months, millions of people convened on the platforms to wager more than $3 billion on the outcome, resulting in a forecast that proved far more accurate than the most highly regarded polls. For the startup's founders, this proved their thesis that the platform's blend of crowdsourced wisdom and financial self-interest offers an unprecedented window into future events. Right now on Kalshi and Polymarket, those future events include profound geopolitical and economic questions like whether China will invade Taiwan by the end of 2025, 6% as of mid-September, or how many rate cuts the Fed will implement by the end of the year, 14% for two cuts. There are also plenty of more frivolous wagers, like whether Taylor Swift will get pregnant in 2025. That's at 15%. To their backers, these wagers, quote-unquote event contracts in prediction markets parlance, represent a promising new industry and a potentially powerful tool that investors could use to hedge their portfolios or that businesses could use to predict consumer demand. Sequoia venture capitalist Alfred Lin describes the markets to Fortune as, quote, basically truth machines, close quote. Seizing on a favorable environment for fintech experimentation, Lin and others have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into Kalshi and Polymarket, each of which now enjoy $1 billion plus unicorn valuations. And a handful of smaller platforms, public companies like Robinhood, are also jostling for a piece of the action. Right now, monthly wagers on Polymarket and Kalshi are totaling well over $1 billion, while analytics firm SimilarWeb says the sites attracted over 35 million visitors this summer. Still, the emerging sector is fraught with risks. While their supporters envision prediction markets as nimble tools for peering into the future, many others, including, it seems, most of the people actually using them, see them as just another way to gamble. If the markets come to be seen primarily as just another casino, they are likely to lose the moral and intellectual high ground their boosters have touted. That's not to mention the challenge of the brutal competition and legal jeopardy that would go with operating in the tightly regulated gaming industry. There's also the public unease around platforms that permit wagers on war or the health of politicians in a time of general social upheaval, an unease intensified by the murder of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. And some question whether the two leading prediction market companies can be trusted to run their startups responsibly. In the past year, the founders of both Kalshi and Polymarket have engaged in eyebrow-raising antics that could give pause to investors and regulators alike. The biggest risk hanging over the industry, though, is a basic business question. Can sites like Kalshi and Polymarket generate sustained interest and revenue outside of the once-in-4 years presidential contest? Prior to election night, nearly $211 million of prediction market bets came flooding in. The following day, gleeful winners lined up to collect, pleased to have anticipated the triumph of the Democratic incumbent Woodrow Wilson. That was in 1916, a year that would prove to be the high watermark of U.S. prediction markets for over a century. When these markets surged back to prominence in last year's Trump-Harris contest, they were clothed in Kalshi and Polymarket's digital wrapper, but the underlying mechanics are very much the same as in the Wilson era. You can think of prediction markets as wagers that are fluid. Unlike casinos, our conventional betting sites, where bettors place a fixed wager against the house, participants on Kalshi and Poly Market bet against one another and can close out their event contract anytime. Like stock exchanges, prediction markets serve as a matching service between buyer and seller. For instance, a contract for a heavily favored election candidate might cost 80 cents, which locks in a dollar payout if the candidate wins. The opposing bettor buys a 20-cent ticket that pays $1 if the other candidate wins. But if the favored candidate suffers a major scandal, the value of that contract might drop to 40 cents, leaving the owner to decide whether to sell it to another bettor or hold it till the election results come in. While this is a form of gambling, proponents argue that any negative social effects are outweighed by the powerful signals the contracts can provide to markets about everything from weather and harvest season to whether a given politician will be elected. In practice, the closer to $1 the value of the event contract comes, the greater the likelihood of the event coming to pass. As the Trump election results demonstrated, the markets can be uncannily accurate, and the more people participate, the more accurate they theoretically become. According to Kalshi co-founder Tariq Mansour, that accuracy is the result of two interlocking factors. Quote, there are market-based mechanisms, so you get the wisdom of the crowds, close quote, he explains. Quote, number two, skin in the game. When people have real money on the line, they don't lie, close quote. Why did something so useful fall out of favor in the first place? The best answer is that prediction markets got swept up in broader progressive era campaigns against gambling, just as the rise of scientific polling pioneered by George Gallup provided a useful alternative. Ironically, the anti-gambling crusades of that era often spared horse racing, since in the eyes of the moralists, it enjoyed an association with rural American virtue, while also teaching young military-age men to size up horse flesh. Robin Hanson, a George Mason University professor, sees the debate over prediction markets as part of a long-time push and pull between those who view tools for speculation as a moral threat and those who see them as useful. Quote, moralizing about betting markets goes up and down in cycles, close quote, Hanson observes. Quote, pretty much all financial markets were illegal at some point, including stocks and life insurance, close quote. In this view, prediction markets are taking their place next to products like options and futures contracts, which regulators long frowned on as overly speculative, but are now viewed as important market signals. Lynn of Sequoia is a Kalshi board member who studied prediction markets in college, and he believes they offer a superior way to hedge against uncertainty, allowing investors to fortify themselves against, for example, adverse internet rate movements. Quote, right now, the way to do that is to look for interest-sensitive stocks and either buy or short-term them, close quote, says Lynn. Quote, there needs to be a better way, close quote. Mansour says firsthand experience led him to the same conclusion. He once worked on the exotics desk of Goldman Sachs, where he built baskets of stocks to help customers take positions on events like Brexit. This push to open prediction markets follows decades of the U.S. banning them, though not entirely. In 1998, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, permitted an entity called the Iowa Electronic Markets to run betting platforms in which a small group of academics could wager very small amounts. The agency then gave permission in 2014 to a successor group, Predictit, to operate a somewhat broader version. In the past 2 years, the legal chains holding back prediction markets have largely vanished. But the current era of these markets is being shaped by startup founders with a penchant for bending the rules. Boog. Shane Kaplan's curly head yells on my iPhone screen shortly before last year's election. It's clear Kaplan is sore over a fortune story that revealed that many of the wagers on Polymarket had come from fishy trades. That revelation didn't dim the general enthusiasm around Polymarket, and in the subsequent months, I repeatedly proposed Zoom or in-person meetings so Kaplan can tell me the full story. Nope. Kaplan prefers to do it his way, with direct messages and ambush video calls over Signal, where he has chosen the Beatles revolver cover as his avatar. The 27-year-old Kaplan, a New York City kid who got deep into cryptocurrency in high school, started Polymarket in 2020 after dropping out of NYU. One of his backers, Rob Haddock of Dragonfly Capital, describes him as brilliant with a deep, all-consuming passion for probabilities. Recent accounts and photos of Copland reflect a founder with a cooler-than-thou effect possessed of deep confidence, or perhaps overconfidence. Recalling encounters with him, two crypto executives told Fortune of Copland comparing himself to Apple founder Steve Jobs. Copland has also brought his swagger to the way he operates his company. In 2022, Polymarket was hit with a CFTC consent decree barring it from operating in the U.S. Despite this, there's ample evidence that the site turned a blind eye to Americans who placed bets by using a VPN to mask their location. Polymarket disputes this characterization. It's quite possible that this conduct, or Polymarket's decision to pay U.S. influencers to promote the site, explained the Justice Department's decision shortly after the election to raid Copland's apartment and seize his smartphone and other devices. The sensible response to a federal raid is to let your lawyers do the talking. Copland chose another strategy. Days later, he took to X to tweet, quote, "New phone, who dis?" close quote. The gesture amounted to taunting the prosecutors, but would ultimately do him no harm. Months later, the feds dropped the investigation without filing charges. If Copland relishes being the enfant terrible of prediction markets, Kalshi's co-founders have taken a different tack. Mansoor and co-founder Luana Lopez Lara are eager to talk up their track record of compliance. This included staying well clear of the U.S. market until September 2024, when Kalshi prevailed in a lawsuit against the CFTC, with a federal judge ruling the agency lacked jurisdiction over event contracts unless they concerned quote-unquote assassination, quote-unquote terrorism, or quote-unquote gaming. Quote, "The Kalshi markets started predicting that COVID was going to pick up again around Thanksgiving a couple years ago, and we made our own return-to-office decisions thinking about this," close quote, she recalls. The prediction proved correct, she adds. Quote, "It was very cool to see and follow it, since you could predict what was going to happen in the news a week later," close quote. Lopez Lara also remembers taking a keen interest in a more trivial wager over whether the band One Direction would reunite and realizing to her deep disappointment that they wouldn't. Ultimately, questions like, quote, "Will Kalshi or Polymarket win the most market share?" close quote, or, quote, "Will an appeals court ban sports betting on prediction markets?" close quote, would be great fodder for a crowdsourced answer from a large group of people with skin in the game. For now, at least, those are two bets you won't find on Kalshi or Polymarket. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.